you're tuned into the sounds of Zach Poff's pond station at Wave Farm and Acre Microphones at the bottom of the pond, recorded earlier today. You can tune in the pond station live at WGXC.org. You're tuned into All Together Now, WGXC's collaborative evening newscast, Monday through Saturday, 6 to 7 p.m. Tonight we'll talk to Robert Miller, who put together the Black Chronicle radio show heard earlier this afternoon on WGXC. And we'll also hear another historical show on WGXC, an excerpt from Jack Senkabal's new show on WGXC, Backtracks in Time. This week, the lifelong Catskill resident talked about the Catskill Railways.
We interrupt this broadcast to bring you a special news bulletin.
Stay tuned to this station.
Stand by for news.
Direct via satellite from our on-the-spot task force.
Good evening from our newsroom in New York.
This is
Daily News and Weather Report.
We take you now to
this radio broadcast.
You are tuned in to All Together Now, a collaborative one-hour news show for community radio stations in the Capital Region and New York's Hudson Valley. All Together Now features contributions from the public, along with programmers at WOOC in Troy and WGXC in Acre, featuring local and regional news, weather updates, and newsmaker interviews.
From the WGXC newsroom, this is the WGXC Hands-On Radio Daily News and Weather Report for Thursday, May 26, 2016. I'm Philip Grant. At the top of the news, John Mason is reporting in the Register Star that the two Republican candidates facing off in the June GOP primary for the 19th Congressional District seat have announced plans to debate in the coming weeks. Former State Assembly Minority Leader John Faso of Kinderhook and Dutchess County businessman Andrew Haney have agreed to hold at least three debates. The first meeting will take place on June the 8th in Cooperstown. That conversation will be moderated by the Oneonta and Cooperstown chapter of the League of Women Voters. The second meeting will be taped on Fios 1 on the afternoon of June the 9th and then broadcast that night. The final debate will be recorded and broadcast by Time Warner's Capital Tonight. Haney originally challenged Faso to six debates, but the number was trimmed to three. However, a Haney representative said the campaign is continuing to seek out locales for additional debates. Democrat Zephyr Teachout and Will Yandick announced 2 weeks ago their plans to hold three debates during the same time period, on June the 7th in Woodstock, June the 8th in Oneonta, and a televised meeting on Time Warner Cable on June the 15th. The primary election is Tuesday, June the 28th, from noon to 9 p.m. Brian Hubert is reporting in the Daily Freeman that more than 50,000 people are expected to flock to Hunter Mountain next week for the 12th annual Mountain Jam. The four-day event will feature more than 40 acts, including Beck, Wilco, and the Abbott Brothers. Songwriter Beck's performance Saturday night will be his first ever in upstate New York. Among the emerging artists scheduled to appear are Nathaniel Ratliff and the Night Sweats, Jason Isbell, Brandy Charlie, and Courtney Barnett. The music begins at 3 p.m. on Thursday, June the 2nd, and will continue through Sunday, June the 5th. Gary Chetkoff, Mountain Jam founder and WDST Radio Woodstock president and principal owner, said despite the 50,000 weekend attendance estimate, the actual daily number is closer to 15,000, which gives the festival a unique intimacy. He said, and I quote, "It's still an intimate experience. It's not overcrowded," end quote. Matthew Hamilton is reporting in the Times Union that legislation to eliminate the state tampon tax is now in the hands of Governor Andrew Cuomo. The governor is expected to sign the measure into law. The state Senate on Wednesday, May the 25th, approved the bill that exempts all feminine hygiene products, including tampons, pads, and sanitary napkins, from the 4% state sales tax. The law would essentially put an end to any county sales tax on the products as well. Certain medical products are already exempted from state sales tax, as are other necessities such as certain foods and drinks. The bill's backers contend that feminine hygiene products fall into a similar category, calling them, and I quote, "an undeniable necessity," end quote. Five states, including Massachusetts, Pennsylvania, and New Jersey, have ended similar taxes. Canada also scrapped its tax on feminine hygiene products in 2015. You can read that full story in the Times Union. The Public Service Commission holds public hearings on May the 26th in Kingston about the state's clean energy standard, which would require utility companies to buy increasing amounts of electricity from renewable and nuclear sources, among many other proposals. The PSC is accepting comments on the clean energy standard proposal through June the 6th and holding several public hearings, including the Kingston event with an afternoon informational session at 2 p.m. and a public hearing from 3 to 5 p.m., an evening information session at 6 p.m., and a public hearing from 7 to 9 p.m. at Kingston City Hall, Council Chambers, second floor, 420 Broadway in Kingston. Greg Hudson is reporting in the Daily Mail that the Tannersville First Farmers Market debuts on Sunday from 10 a.m. to 2 p.m. in the large municipal lot behind Last Chance Antiques and Cheese Cafe. There will be produce, flowers, crafts, goat milk, baked goods, and other farm products, according to Ann Jabowski, executive director of the Hunters Foundation. The foundation is also putting on the Memorial Day weekend event throughout the town, such as the rubber duck races and the carnival at Rip Van Winkle Lake. The carnival opens on May the 27th from 5 p.m. to 10 p.m. and is open on May the 28th and 29th from noon to 11 p.m. and on Memorial Day from noon to 3 p.m. The duck race begins on Main Street at 11 a.m. on May the 28th with a crazy boat race at 2 p.m. The town's Memorial Day parade is at noon Sunday on Main Street. You can read that full story in the Daily Mail. And for our final story, Casey Sealer in the Albany Times Union reports that Governor Andrew Cuomo is making something of a political stunt on May the 24th. At the end of the legislative session, without any ethics action, but with the recent prison sentencing of the former leaders of the Assembly and Senate, Cuomo proposed 8 bills that would, in varying degrees, close the so-called LLC loophole, which lets limited liability companies make far larger political donations than individuals or corporations. While taking questions from reporters outside his office, Cuomo said, and I quote, "The point I'm trying to make is, I propose closing the LLC loophole for everyone, every elected office, Republican Party, and Democratic Party. I've proposed it before, it's gone nowhere. So now I'm asking, okay, any of the above. If you're unwilling to do it for yourself, do it just for me," end quote. Senate Republican leader John Flanagan, who is the majority leader even though there are more Democrats in the Senate, said in a statement that the governor's proposal, and I quote, "fails to fundamentally address the root cause of the problems that exist within our campaign finance system, most notably a lack of enforcement, a lack of transparency, and a lack of full and honest disclosure," end quote. You can read that full story in the Albany Times Union.
National Weather Service says there is a chance of showers or thunderstorms overnight, 30% chance with a low around 64. Friday, again, 30% chance of showers or thunderstorms, mainly after 2 p.m., otherwise partly sunny, the high near 83. Friday night, again, there's a 30% chance of rain, mainly before 8 p.m., with a low around 63. Saturday, the chance of rain rises to 40%, mainly after 1 p.m., otherwise partly sunny, with a high near 84, and a low around 66 Saturday night.
You are listening to the WGXC News Update. I'm Alana Medlock. Governor Andrew Cuomo announced $59.3 million in state and federal funding for upstate transit authorities on May 26th, with almost a million set for Greene, Columbia, and Rensselaer counties. Greene County gets $489,916,000 for 3 buses and mobility management services. Columbia County gets $260,000 for operating assistance, vehicle replacement, and equipment, and $110,000 goes to Rensselaer County for operating assistance. Farther south, Ulster County receives $534,000 for operating assistance and 1 new bus, and Dutchess County gets $183,000 for operating assistance. Carrie Allen reports in the Register Star that Chatham Bowl closes after 53 years on Tuesday, May 31st. The general public, Chatham's varsity bowling team, and cast members for an episode of an Australian reality television show were among the bowlers over the years in Chatham, where computerized scorekeeping was never added. Chet Cross drew up the blueprints, and his wife Carol took over when he died in 1986. In 2005, the couple's daughter Lynn Cross and her husband Ted Miner bought the bowling alley. Now, though, they're looking forward to June 1st. Quote, it will be my first day off in years, Miner said. Read the full story in the Register Star. Melissa Hale Spencer reports in the Altamont Enterprise that four board members in the Albany County town of Knox held a private meeting May 8th, quote, advised by town attorney John Dorfman, without town superintendent Vasilios Lefkadidis or the public. Robert Freeman, director of the state's Committee on Open Government, said the meeting is a violation of the state's open meetings law. Why hold a secret illegal meeting? Quote, we wanted to sort out information we were considering with health insurance, coming after the misinformation we got about the workers' compensation policy at the March meeting, said Amy Picorni, Knox's deputy superintendent. So there's some sort of dispute between the board and the government in Knox that could not wait two more days for the regular public town board meeting May 10th? Quote, we were having trouble communicating with him, Picorni said about Lefkadidis. Quote, it's difficult because he flies into rages sometimes. We were trying to understand what this is about. It's hard to have a reasonable and temperate conversation. The meeting was helpful to us. We were able to sort through and prepare for the public meeting. It was like committee work, end quote. Read the full story in the Altamont Enterprise. Brigitte Sayegh at Time Warner News reports that a picket line with dozens of correction officers protested for safety awareness outside the Shawangunk Correctional Facility in Ulster County on May 25th. Quote, this is part of our public awareness campaign, said NYS COPBA President Michael Powers. The day before, on May 24th, the Daily Mail reported that 18-year-old Devon Binda, an inmate at Green Correctional Facility, was arrested and charged with promoting prison contraband with a, quote, razor blade-style cutting weapon, end quote. That was just the sort of case Powers and other protesters were there to highlight, as he said there has been a 55% rise in violence by inmates recently. Quote, we have seen an increase in staffing in the last couple of years, but with everything there's always room for improvement and we'll continue to push for that, he said. Responding to reports about Fishkill Correctional inmate Samuel Harrell, who was beaten to death last year by a group of correctional officers, Powers said 99% of officers create a safe environment for the inmate population. Quote, my brother's case was not a case where they felt unsafe, end quote, said Sarissa Harrell, Samuel's sister. Quote, they just took the law into their own hands, and I don't know, my brother's not here now, and that's just not fair, end quote. Read the full story at Time Warner News.
And that wraps up the WGXC Hands-On Radio Daily News and Weather Report for today, Thursday, the 26th day of May 2016. From the WGXC Newsroom, I'm Philip Grant. Have a good day and a pleasant tomorrow.
Here with Robert Miller in the WGXC Acra studio, and Robert has just put together a show called The Black Chronicle. Robert, do you want to tell us what that is?
The Black Chronicle is a journalistic presentation of African American history that is published in the form of 14 tabloid newspapers, each one dated at a key or turning point in African American history. It begins in the American Revolution, and our program focuses and takes advantage of that first issue and goes up through the Civil Rights era in the 1950s. In each of the issues of the Black Chronicle, we've taken a key event in African-American history, and we've used it as the lead story in a four-page tabloid newspaper that we then build around the lead story using features, news articles, advertisements, political cartoons, social notices, everything and anything. So we, in effect, create what I think of as a multifaceted moment in history. And the Black Chronicle publication reflects in its design and also in its writing style the designs and writing styles of the broadsheets or the newspapers of the historical period. Now, what we've done in today's show or in the show that we're broadcasting is we've looked at the first issue, 1778, and we've looked at the Rhode Island Assembly's decision to offer African slaves their freedom in exchange for fighting for the Rhode Island militia. Now, this was a highly controversial bit of legislation, but at this point in the war, it was necessary because there was a desperate need of manpower. And we see throughout the Black Chronicle that African Americans were called into service for precisely that reason. They acquitted themselves brilliantly. And there were advantages or advances that normally followed the wars. It happened in the American Revolution. It happened, God knows, in the Civil War, in the First World War, in the Second World War. And so what we've done in the program is we've taken some advertisements, we've taken the lead story about the Rhode Island Assembly, and we have a short 5 or 6 minute drama in which we listen to some of the arguments back and forth in the assembly for and against offering African Americans their freedom. That period of time obviously was a fascinating one because the question of freedom on the one hand for the 13 colonies and the ownership of human beings as property on the other were inevitably coming into conflict. And for example, Thomas Jefferson actually drafted, despite his kind of up and down history when it comes to owning and treating his African slaves, he actually drafted a clause for the Declaration of Independence condemning George III for promoting the slave trade. But that clause was blocked by Southern delegates to the convention. And in any case, our program today runs about 27 minutes. I think it's fascinating, and I think it's a really good example of what the Black Chronicle does. Tom, I can tell you a little bit about how I developed it and why.
Sure.
If you're interested. Until recently, I was working for Channel 13 in New York City. That's the flagship public television station in New York. And I was director of educational publishing. I worked with all of the great television producers, Bill Moyers, Rick Burns, David Gruben. And what I did was I developed education materials for use in schools and colleges, churches, synagogues, mosques, so that educators could use the programs in their classes. And so I had a marvelous career at WNET. But when I retired 3 or 4 years ago, I went back to the two projects that had kind of set me on the path of educational publishing. And the first was the Black Chronicle. When I was 28 years old, I was an actor, and I had an idea. This was in the late 1960s, and I was in a play called Riot. It was a play that the theater company that I belonged to created. We were called the Ohm Theater Workshop, and it was based on the riots that were happening in the late 60s. The play began with a panel discussion between a white moderate, that was me, a white conservative, kind of a Rush Limbaugh type, a black militant, and a black moderate. And the panel discussion was supposed to be about finding a solution to the issues of race relations. It will give you some idea of the the perspective of the producers that the discussion broke up into a fist fight. But during the discussion, the audience found themselves surrounded by people in black leotards doing slow motion gestures that we as dancers and actors had taken from the scenes of the riots in the 1960s. There was frisking and being frisked. Two actors would kind of slowly go into the frisk, being frisked position and the frisking position. There was clubbing and being clubbed. And these slow motion kind of black clad figures doing these gestures throughout the audience gradually increased in intensity until when the panel discussion broke into a fist fight, the entire theater space became a riot under strobe with burning tires and sirens. It was quite remarkable. In fact, the play won an Obie Award. We presented it off Broadway. Well, at that time, when I was in the play Riot, I was also writing for an education magazine called Colloquy. And my focus was on the failure of American education, especially in the area of celebrating the contributions of minorities. And at the time, of course, black history was one of the flags that was raised by those of us in the 60s who were protesting, rebelling, whatever you want to call it. Well, the play was successful on the one hand, critically successful, but unfortunately, we opened on the same day of a citywide newspaper strike, and all of the good reviews were read by nobody except us. So the play closed, and I had gotten an idea when I was interviewing someone for one of my articles on the teaching of American history, and the idea was to present African American history using the format of a series of newspapers, tabloid newspapers. I thought it was a great idea because newspapers use the kind of appeal of headlines and attractive writing, engaging writing, to deliver information. And it was a natural to me. It was something that I decided that I would give a try. I would give it a try. Now here we are. What is it? 50 years later, and I'm kind of asking myself the question: How could I, as a white guy, take it upon myself to do a project like this? And all I can say is, when I think back on it, is that this was a time of turmoil. The late 60s. We all believed. I remember it as crystal clear. That the world was changing for the better, that things were going to be different, and I had an idea that I thought would change education. And so, as a member of what we thought of ourselves as the generation of change, I decided to give it a try. I had no money, so I lived on a houseboat for a year on the 79th Street Pier in Manhattan, and every day I went back and forth to the Schomburg collection of the New York Public Library, which is one of the best collections of African American history in the world, to create a prototype issue. And the one that I chose, the lead story that I chose, was the Dred Scott decision. And the reason I chose that was because it was just before the Civil War. The country was split down the middle, and frankly, it felt like the country was kind of echoing that in the late 60s. And so that it seemed like a good place to start. And so I created and wrote this four-page newspaper. I had great research. I had the newspapers of the period, the abolitionist newspapers, both black and white abolitionist newspapers. And then I also had the best secondary sources: Lerone Bennett, Benjamin Quarles, C. Van Woodward, John Hope Franklin. And I structured the issue so it was historically complete. It gave a spectrum, a feeling for that period. And I used the original documents as a way of kind of launching myself into articles that I thought would be appealing. Well, at the end of a year, I had an issue. I had a full 4-page issue, and I thought I could get it published easily. In fact, I thought it was going to change the world. But I couldn't get anywhere. It was I was white. I didn't have a track record. But I was very lucky because I found Blackside and Henry Hampton. Blackside is the company that you'll maybe be familiar with because they eventually produced Eyes on the Prize, the Pulitzer-winning civil rights public television series. And I had gone to school with one of Henry Hampton, who was the founder and the president, with one of his close colleagues. His name was Howard Diamond, and he introduced me to Henry, and Henry saw the idea, and he said, "Rob, I'm going to give you a home to do this. I think it's a great idea." Because Henry and Blackside, they were interested in social justice, and they welcomed anyone of any race who had an idea that they felt was worthwhile. And so they gave me a home in Roxbury to develop the Black Chronicle. And 2 years later, we had a contract with Holt Reinhart and Winston, the publisher. And I had done 14 issues of the Black Chronicle, a teacher's guide with 14 chapters, two LP records. We had LP records at the time with dramatic kind of short dramas for each of the 14 issues, and 14 overhead transparencies. And this was organized into a school package that Holt Reinhart and Winston began to sell. It was a triumph for all of us. I then went on to another project called La Cronica. It was funded in part by the Ford Foundation, and that was Mexican-American history. I went out to California. First, I went to Mexico to do some preliminary research. Then I came back, and with a small group of writers and historians in Los Angeles and a large group of researchers throughout the Southwest, we created La Cronica, which is bilingual, and it presents Mexican-American history using the same format, except each of the 9 issues are 4 pages of English and 4 pages of Spanish. And La Cronica is fascinating because it begins in 1835 when the Southwest, California, New Mexico, Arizona, they were all part of northern Mexico, and it was a serene time. Unlike the Black Chronicle, which began in the middle of the Revolutionary War, the turmoil.
Stay tuned. In just a moment, we'll hear more from Robert Miller about the Black Chronicle.
You're tuned into the sounds of Zach Poff's Pond Station at Wave Farm in Acre, microphones at the bottom of the pond, recorded earlier today. You can tune in the Pond Station live at wgxc.org.
Here's a little more Robert Miller talking about the Black Chronicle that aired earlier today on WGXC.
But now that both La Cronica and Black Chronicle are being distributed by myself on my website, which is ourhistoryasnews.org. And so Tom, that's kind of the story.
What was it like trying, what was your approach, I guess, to turning stories from a newspaper based in a time before radio into a radio stories?
Good question. We're lucky enough to have the dramatic episodes for each of the issues. the one that I mentioned for issue one, our first of what we I think we all hope will be many, is again the dramatized version of the Rhode Island Assembly's debate over whether or not to permit slaves to fight for this freedom. So I present a kind of you are there introduction. It's 1878, winter, the war is raging. The colonial armies are lacking manpower. General Washington recently changed his stance on whether to offer slaves their freedom in exchange for fighting for the colonial armies. Let's listen in to the Rhode Island Assembly as it debates the issue. Something like that's how it begins. And then we listen to the debate, and then we go on and read myself, Philip Grant, Mark Bailey, Donna Ramirez, we read articles with kind of short descriptions before each to give a sense of that period.
And these are all local people?
Phil Grant is a news
on WGXC,
GXC. Mark He's Bailey is Nassau. Connected with GSC. Donna Ramirez is a painter in this area, and me. And I am bringing Black Chronicle and La Chronica to schools. And I give workshops. In fact, we're planning a workshop at the Riverside Church in New York City in the fall that we're calling Black Lives Have Always Mattered. And what we're looking at is the way the ongoing incidents of violence and oppression against African Americans have been met by powerful and brilliant and effective responses by African Americans, by African American leaders, and by what we call the Rainbow Community, which would include me. And we'll begin with the late 1800s, with Plessy versus Ferguson, and we'll go from there to the Niagara Movement, W.E.B. Du Bois and William Monroe Trotter, and we'll go up through the First World War and the Red Summer, and up through the civil rights era and the Montgomery bus boycott, which is the lead story in the last issue of Black Chronicle, and we've got there's kind of martial colonial era music along with the 27-minute piece, and I think it worked out really well.
And if you just tuned in, we're talking to Robert Miller, who puts together the Black Chronicle newspaper and is just. Turned it into a radio story that's now on WGXC and available in the WGXC archives to listen to. And you're making subsequent episodes?
Well, we're hoping to. This is the first of what we hope will be more. I think we now have a template that we can use for subsequent programs. Our hope is that we can do Black Chronicle issues and then move on to La Chronica. Which again is Mexican American history from the early 1800s up through the civil rights movement in the late 1960s, the Chicano movement.
And have you, in the course of all the research, found anything local? Is there local history included?
Well, W.E.B. Du Bois was brought up not far from here in Massachusetts. His house is a historical landmark, and I believe Harriet Tubman settled in New York State. And of course we have a lot of homes that still boast basements that were used as part of the Underground Railroad. So there's a great history.
That was mostly more to the west, up through Rochester and Syracuse.
Mm-hmm. Right. We have them not far from us in Middleburg and Caro, and there's a long and honorable history of. Anti-slavery activity in upstate New York. Yeah, absolutely. You know, I developed the Black Chronicle and La Chronica as much or maybe more for the white community than I did for the African American or the Hispanic community, because I think it's the white community that really needs to know this stuff. It enriches all of our history.
And if people want to find out more information, they should go to ourhistoryisnews.org?
That's it, ourhistoryisnews.org.
All right. Thank you, Robert Miller, for joining us today.
Tom, it's my pleasure.
And you can tune in the Black Chronicle on WGXC.org on the website in the archives. Our next story comes from host Jack Sankabaugh, lifelong Catskill resident, starting a new show called Backtracks in Time with Greene County History. This week he listens in on Catskill Mountain Railway, the Otis Elevating Railway, and the Catskill and Tannersville Railway, live from the Carnegie Room at the Catskill Library from May 24th.
Welcome to Backtracks in Time on WGXC 90.7. Since this is our first show, allow me to introduce myself. My name is Jack Sankabaugh, and I am a lifelong 45-year resident of Catskill. I enjoy the history of the area, its natural beauty, and living in a small town. This village has had its ups and downs over the years, but has always come back. Right now, with several new businesses on Main Street and the arrival of the American Dance Institute on Water Street in the former Dunn's Hardware Building, it seems to be in very good shape. As our former village president Vincent Seely would say, it is the ever-improving village of Catskill, and if I have my way, I will never leave. You could say that my involvement in local history began at a fairly young age. I've always been interested in trains and railroads, and for my 9th birthday, I was given the book Rip Van Winkle Railroads by William Helmer. Not only did I enjoy reading about the railroads and seeing the photos of the trains, but it also included old pictures of Catskill. So you could say that was the germ of my interest in local history. In my 20s, I would go with my dad to talks given by our late town historian, Betty Larson. Some of her topics included urban redevelopment in Catskill, major fires, and various other subjects. Her knowledge was incredible, and it was enjoyable to hear her share it. Perhaps I can discuss some of these topics on upcoming editions of this show. But the event that really kept me going with our history, as a hobby, was the opening of the Freightmasters Museum building at historic Catskill Point in 2001. In fact, on the day it opened, Saturday of Memorial Weekend, it was pouring rain and the building was packed. As soon as I stepped inside, the door hadn't even closed behind me yet, Betty Larson was sitting at her table and asked me, "Would you like to volunteer here, Jack?" I told her to give me a few minutes to walk around and look at everything. After touring the building, I went back to her and asked for a pen and asked where to sign up. I've been volunteering there for 15 years now, and it's something I enjoy sharing my love of local history with visitors and using my Sankabaugh gift of gab that I inherited from my father, Jack. There are some visitors that I can still remember clearly from all these years. And it's also a pleasure to work with Dick Brooks, the manager of Historic Catskill Point and the museum. You may be familiar with Dick from his column Whittling Away in the Columbia Green newspapers. He's a retired teacher and former member of the Greene County Legislature. He also possesses a wealth of knowledge of the area. I'd like to have him on the show on an upcoming show one of these days. Dick just doesn't know it yet, but he will be on. Actually, it is due to volunteering at the museum that I have this program. In September of last year, I showed one particular visitor around the museum. When I was done, she commented that I seemed to know quite a bit about the area, then told me that she worked for WGXC and would like to put me on the air. This was DJ Neva Wartell, who hosts Music for the Masses that you just heard. In October, I was interviewed by Jill Sutton on the Tuesday afternoon show. And following that interview, Neva had the idea to give me my own show. And 7 months later, here we are. So thank you, Neva. Now let's just hope she doesn't live to regret it. Anyway, now that you know my background, why don't we take a topic of history and discuss it? I thought we would start with the railroads, since that's where I got my start in local history, and since I want to start the show off on the right track. And yes, you will also be subject to my corny sense of humor if you keep listening to this show. Another gift from my dad. Before we get into the railroads themselves, however, I think we need to talk about what attracted vacationers to the Catskills in the first place. At that time, in the 19th century, long before the ski resorts and music festivals, it was the tremendous beauty of our area. Artists such as Thomas Cole and Frederick Church showed this beauty in their paintings, thus making Greene County well known. Visitors, especially those wishing to escape the heat and noise of the city, could come here and spend a week, a month, or perhaps the whole summer, and most of them did, in hotels such as the Catskill Mountain House and Hotel Catterskill, and enjoy the fresh, clean mountain air. According to many of the hotel advertisements, This clean air could cure all your ailments. Thus, Greene County and the Catskills became a major destination for travelers. And now, along with the material that I'm going to be reading, we'll have a few musical interludes to fill in some of the time, and appropriate songs, railroad songs. My other hobby is classic country music and trains, so I'm going to incorporate that in here too. And the first song you're going to be hearing is called Wabash Cannonball, recorded by a man who was known as the King of Country Music and a member of the Grand Ole Opry for 50 years, Roy Acuff. And here's Wabash Cannonball.
From the great Atlantic Ocean to the wide Pacific shore, from the Queen of Glowing Mountain to the South Bell by the shore, she's mighty tall and handsome and known quite well by all. She's the combination on the Wabash Cannonball. She came down from Birmingham one cold December day. As she rolled into the station, you could hear all the people say, there's a girl from Tennessee, she's long and she's tall. She came down from Birmingham on the Wabash Cannonball. Our eastern states are dandies, so the people always say, from New York to St. Louis and Chicago by the way, from the hills of Minnesota where the rippling waters fall, no changes can be taken on that Wabash Cannonball. Here's to Daddy Claxton, may his name forever stand and always be remembered round the courts of Alabama. His earthly race is over and the curtain will carry him home to victory on the Wabash Cannonball. Listen to the jingle, the rumble and the roar, as she glides along the woodland through the hills and by the shore. Hear the mighty rush of the engine, yeah, that lonesome hobo's call. Hear traveling through the jungles on the Wabash Cannonball.
You're tuned into the sounds of Zach Poff's Pond Station at Wave Farm in Acre, microphones at the bottom of the pond, recorded earlier today. You can tune in the Pond Station live at WGXC.org.
Next, the national headlines from Public News Service.
Welcome to the Public News Service Daily Newscast for Thursday, May the 26th, 2016. I'm Mike Clifford. On today's rundown, states sue over transgender bathroom directives, while a new report finds the justice system is failing transgender people. Utah may revert to the firing squad. Congress finally tackles toxic substances. And vigilance, the byword, as we splash into summer swimming season.
Topping our news, 11 states filed suit Wednesday challenging the Obama administration move directing schools to allow transgender students to use restrooms that match their gender identities. The Washington Post reports the lawsuit filed in the U.S. District Court for the Northern District of Texas states that the guidance has no basis in law, adding it could cause seismic changes in the operations of the nation's school districts. Meantime, transgender people end up behind bars at much higher rates than others, and once there, they are subjected to harassment, abuse, and violence. That's according to a study by the Movement Advancement Project and the Center for American Progress.
Policy and Research Director Naomi Goldberg says 21% of transgender women have been in jail or prison, as well as 10% of transgender men, while only 5% of the entire adult population has. She says once a transgender person does run afoul of the law, their research found they aren't treated properly.
Everything from being placed in an inappropriate facility because of their gender identity, to lack of access to medical care, to high rates of sexual assault by both staff and other incarcerated people.
Goldberg says once they're released from prison, there's a lack of support for people who have a criminal record to find jobs and housing, so many people just end up back behind bars. I'm Veronica Carter.
And with the drugs most commonly used for lethal injections no longer available, Mark Richardson reports the state of Utah may revert to carrying out death sentences with a firing squad.
The state has used lethal injection for most of its executions since 1977, but firing squads have remained an option in some cases. Ronald Dunham, executive director of the Death Penalty Information Center, says the Utah legislature passed a bill in 2015 specifying that firing squads would be used if lethal drugs could not be obtained.
The reason they went to lethal injection was because they did not like the image that was portrayed by using firing squad. So they thought it was bad for the state.
Utah has used firing squads throughout most of the state's history and recently used one in an execution in 2010. Dunham says there are currently 9 people waiting on Utah's death row, although no execution dates have been set. He says earlier this year, a bill to end the death penalty passed in the state Senate, but never came to a vote in the House.
Dunham says in recent years, several polls have shown that among people who back the use of the death penalty, the majority support lethal injections, but do not approve of using other more violent methods. It has been a long road, paved with court battles and compromise, but Maine voters will get a chance to decide whether the state should legalize pot on the November ballot. David Boyer manages the Maine chapter of the campaign to regulate marijuana like alcohol. He says the ballot initiative survived court challenges, but had to make some concessions in regard to protecting minors. That's fine with Boyer.
We're not going to be, you know, advertising marijuana products to children, just like we shouldn't advertise marijuana products to children. We can learn from the tobacco industry and the alcohol industry. And, you know, I don't think we should repeat Joe Camel.
Joe Camel was the advertising mascot for Camel cigarettes from 1987 to 1997. The ballot initiative that goes to Maine voters in November would put some restrictions on magazines whose primary focus is marijuana or the marijuana business. A bill to significantly strengthen the Toxic Substances Control Act should soon be law. Andrea Sears explains.
The 1976 law made it almost impossible to evaluate the safety and control the use of the more than 80,000 chemicals sold in the United States. In fact, only about 200 have been adequately tested by the EPA. Eve Gartner of Earth Justice says the reforms that passed the House of Representatives on Tuesday will be a huge improvement.
EPA now has much broader authority to require the testing of those chemicals and then to actually regulate those chemicals if it concludes that they pose risks.
The bill passed the House with only 12 dissenting votes and is expected to get unanimous approval in the Senate. President Obama has said he will sign it into law.
That reform bill is a compromise between the House and Senate versions. It requires the EPA to test 10 chemicals a year, expanding to 20 as protocols are established. And finally, whether it's Lake Michigan or a neighborhood pool, summer means swim time. No matter the level of swimming experience, Mary Sherman tells us safety experts say all people need to use caution around the water.
Dr. Brad Uren, an emergency physician with the University of Michigan, says first and foremost, children and adults alike should know the basics of swimming, even if they aren't interested in the water.
If they find themselves, if they fall off of a boat, if they fall into a pool or into water, to have that really essential life skill of how to swim and how to save themselves, that's critical. It can be life and death.
And while children under age 5 are in the group with the highest risk of drowning, Erin says parents should keep an eye on children of all ages when they're swimming. Diving is also a concern, which Erin says can result in spinal cord injury. He notes that folks should only dive in swimming pools where it is allowed and never into natural bodies of water.
As we know here in Michigan, winter can change things a lot. Water levels can be up or down. Currents can be different. There may be rocks, trees, other submerged hazards. So make sure that you really understand where you are and what the hazards are.
It's always a good idea to swim with a buddy and pay attention to anyone nearby. I'm Mike Clifford for Public News Service, member and listener supported, and online at publicnewsservice.org.
National Weather Service says there is a chance of showers or thunderstorms overnight, 30% chance, with a low around 64. Friday, again, 30% chance of showers or thunderstorms, mainly after 2 p.m., otherwise partly sunny, with a high near 83. Friday night, again, there's a 30% chance of rain, mainly before 8 p.m., low around 63. Saturday, the chance of rain rises to 40%, mainly after 1 p.m. Otherwise, partly sunny with a high near 84 and a low around 66 Saturday night.
Thanks, 10-4.
You're listening to Radio News About Radio Waves. Headlines from the ether. Headlines.
Net neutrality may be an issue that's never quite settled. Courts have struck down versions in the past, and they may again in the future. The U.S. House of Representatives just passed the No Rate Regulation of Broadband Internet Access Act, which would undermine the FCC's ability to enforce net neutrality rules, and is now in the U.S. Senate. The law is currently in effect, supposedly equalizing the internet for both home users and giant corporations, but the telecom companies have already found a way around it. Zero rating is the latest loophole used by telecom companies to get around net neutrality rules, with carriers exempting certain services, such as Spotify or Netflix, from a customer's data plan. Net neutrality advocates say this gives certain types of data priority over others, when net neutrality is meant to create an even playing field for all. Quote, widely embraced, zero rating threatens to rewrite the rules upon which the internet was built, unquote, Electronic Frontier Foundation legal director Corinne McSherry told Gizmodo. Quote, zero rating helps transform the internet from a permissionless environment into one in which developers effectively need to seek approval from ISPs before deploying their latest groundbreaking technology, unquote. This week, 58 tech companies, Reddit, Yelp, Kickstarter among them, sent a letter to the FCC asking for an open discussion about zero rating, as the agency is looking at the practice, but not holding public hearings. This is Tom Rowe for Wave Farm Radio and WGXC.
This is Tamara with the community calendar for WGXC. Go to WGXC.org and click on the community calendar to find out more about what's going on in your community. And you can even add your own event. Click on the Add an Event button and copy and paste the information about your local community event in. Soon folks like me will read it on the radio, and folks around the world will see it online at WGXC.org in the community calendar. Friday, May 27th, Hudson Historic Preservation Commission meets at 10 a.m. at the Hudson City Hall. Morgan O'Kane and Vic Thrill perform at the Half Moon in Hudson at 8 p.m. Friday, May 27th.
Next
It's time for the Hudson Valley Song of the Day, a performance from a musician visiting the Capital Region or Hudson Valley, or who regularly plays around these parts.
From Hillsdale, here's Pigeons and Radio Souvenir.